Okay. We are ready. Yes. Come in, come in. Welcome one, welcome all. So we just have a few comments to finish up chapter 9. We had talked about thinking of an atom, right? Usually you have a handful of electrons, like if it's a terbium or barium, calcium, atom with a couple of valence electrons that tend to mostly have their orbitals on the exterior of the atom. And then if there's a charged Z nucleus, then you get some sort of effective charge as a function of distance that goes from a peak of the nucleus at r equals zero and then decays down. If you think of the charge one electron sees as you pull it out at different distances from the nucleus, it goes at large distances, if it's a neutral atom, to one at infinity. See, it goes back and sees just a single charge left behind. And so you can sort of make some order of magnitude estimates for the strength of the multipoles, mostly controlled by the size of these orbitals. And for instance, I think I showed this formula last time, that the strength in atoms of a magnetic multiple of order L divided by the electric multiple radiation. This would be imagining the decay rate of a bound excited state due to radiation. It goes like the Z effective over 137, which is basically Z effective times alpha. So for a valence state where Z effective, the average charge seen by the electron is closer to this value unity, because it lives out here somewhere most of the time. There's a suppression of magnetic multiples over electric by about 10 to the 4. Whereas if you look at an inner shell transition, like let's say you create a vacancy in the 1s shell, maybe by a charged particle collision, then the electrons in the 2p orbital, deep inner shell orbital, will see Z effective closer to the Z of the nucleus for that decay, and electric and magnetic multiples might be getting much more comparable. So that's how magnetic and electric multiples compare. Also, in terms of just electric multiples alone, the L plus first over the Lth, like the quadrupole to the dipole, has a similar suppression of this Z effective over 137. And that's kind of how the decay rates scale with the different multiples in atoms for atomic radiative transitions. These estimates don't really work for nuclei. In nuclei, magnetic and electric dipoles are more comparable. And there's a discussion of that in Jackson at the end of this section of the chapter 9. So I think that's all I wanted to say about chapter 9. Now, chapter 10, the last chapter of using SI units in Jackson. And we get to switch to Gaussian units, which are so much more friendly for relativity. And I know I don't have official office hours today, but I'll be in my office pretty much all afternoon if you want to ask about the homework or anything. Okay, chapter 10, We're going to talk about scattering first and then diffraction of electromagnetic waves. And there's a pretty simple picture. Let's focus on scattering for now of how to think about this. That basically you have incident radiation on some object. And it's electric. Its E field can induce an electric dipole in the material, in the object. And we're doing all this monochromatically now. It could also induce a higher multiple in some cases. And less important usually is there could be a magnetic multiple. And these are all going to be going at the standard monochromatic rate, all at e to the minus I omega t for some incident radiation. So we're thinking more monochromatic, not the attosecond laser pulse. And then what happens? You've got an oscillating multiple moment like P of t going up and down. If you came in, if you had incident radiation linearly polarized, and then that sends out radiation basically just as an ordinary dipole. And that radiation coming out is what we call the scattered photons or scattered radiation. And there are different levels we could look at. We might sometimes be interested in detecting this radiation, just the total power radiated. But sometimes we might be interested in putting a polarization-sensitive detector there, catch the photons with the different polarization possibilities. And of course, we can calculate all that because we know how to do math. So first, I'm going to tackle the easiest scenario, which is, I guess, section 10.1, which is the long wavelength limit. And I'm going to model the scatterer for simplicity. Let's say that we have incident light in vacuum. And it's going to strike a dielectric sphere. And let's give it radius A. And let's say it has it's a linear dielectric with dielectric constant epsilon r, relative dielectric constant epsilon r. Remember, that's epsilon over epsilon naught. And we'll say it's monochromatic and has wavelength lambda much larger than the size of the sphere A. Because of this, we can make some simplifying approximations. In particular, we can treat the incident radiation field, right? We've got a dielectric sphere. We have very long wavelength limit. We'll approximate the electric field as constant over the small size of the sphere. So in other words, in our electromagnetic plane wave coming in, we're setting this to be unity. And that's, of course, only in the region where the dipole will be formed in the dielectric sphere for distances r less than a. All the time dependences, again, are e to the minus I omega t everywhere. And what we're going to calculate is the electric dipole radiation, which is the scattered radiation, and we'll explore its properties, the directions in space where it's strongest, the polarization nature of these photons coming out. When we apply this to the atmosphere to understand why the sky is blue, when we just look around, except on days when it's green, we should think of these particles as not individual molecules, but more as like usually maybe dust particles are mostly doing the scattering. Things more comparable, a little closer to the size of the wavelength of the light that we're looking at. Okay, so let's do the math. We have all the tools. So first, let's look at the incident radiation to start with. Let's just focus on the electric field, which whose directions are what we talk about when we're talking about the polarization. The incident radiation we'll pick to be a complex monochromatic field like we've talked about, only the real parts of which in any thing we calculate should be, always should take the real part. But the math is simpler. Let's pick the z-axis for our incident propagation direction coming in on our dielectric sphere with polarization vector E naught. Unit vector. Okay, so we treated back in chapter 4, I guess, a dielectric sphere placed in a uniform electric field, E naught. Okay, so you probably won't be too surprised to know that in this limit, this where the field is constant across the sphere, the formula is exactly the same, except for the time dependence e to the minus I omega t. So we're going to assume the magnetic permeability is approximately unity. We'll have the relative dielectric constant is, of course, going to be different from 1, so that the electric field sees there's something different about this spherical particle than the vacuum the photons came in from. And we can basically use equation 4.56 and derive P of t through more or less the same logic there. So the formula we had there, 4 pi epsilon naught, epsilon r minus 1 over epsilon r plus 2, the radius cubed times our incident field, E naught, unit vector E naught, e to the minus I omega t. And we have an oscillating dipole moment, electric dipole moment, of this dielectric sphere. Right, so I guess in this geometry, the photon would be maybe coming in this direction with linear polarization, and now it's going to induce a dipole moment in the sphere P, given by that formula. And this would be our z-axis, coming in the incidence direction of the photons, propagation. So that's nice when we don't have to go back to Maxwell's equations and do heavy duty calculations. We can just use this result from chapter 4 for our oscillating dipole. And now we have everything already worked out for an oscillating dipole previously in chapter 9. And we can write out the fields radiated by this dipole, induced dipole, which is equation 919 in our favorite tome, which says the scattered photons have a magnetic field H equal to CK squared over 4 pi, direction of propagation n hat crossed into P, dipole moment vector, and in the radiation zone with this R dependence, far away from the scatterer, which is where we usually would go to calculate the radiated power, which we'll be doing shortly. And then the electric field, the scattered radiation. We have the usual impedance of free space. In the radiation zone, we can just take the cross product of Z naught H scattered with the propagation direction. So that's both of those are in the radiation zone. And then one of the most important things to calculate is the angular distribution of scattered radiation. Right, that is an energy per unit time per unit solid angle, dP power. That's capital P now, not dipole moment. Maybe I'll try to make it capital. dP d omega. Right, power per unit solid angle, d omega. From 9.22, we can just grab that formula. C squared z naught k to the fourth over 32 pi squared, k, of course, is our wave number of our incident radiation, which is going to be the same wave number in the scattered radiation. Coming out at some k n hat direction. And this is, by the way, the time averaged already. And this is how we usually like to write the angular distribution. When we write it as the square of a vector, usually for the total power, you could write this either in terms of the magnetic field direction vector inside or the electric, but usually the convention is to pick the electric field vector when you write a formula like this, and that way you can see at a glance not only the angular distribution, but you can see the polarization as well, because if you remember that you've done it that way, you've written this as the electric field direction inside the absolute square, then now you know the polarization also, which we'll look at in a minute. So I guess you're going to force me to write out this formula now and plug in P from there into here. I can do that. But it'll be fun to stare at then and think about what it means. Twilight Zone music ensues. Okay. So, I'll just remind you, Z naught is mu naught over epsilon naught to the 1/2. And another thing worth remembering is that Z naught epsilon naught is 1 over the speed of light in vacuum. And maybe I'll skip one line of algebra and give the final result. dp d omega is 1 over z naught magnitude of e naught squared times k to the fourth a to the sixth over 2 magnitude of n hat cross e naught squared, which actually, according to my strategy, I should not write that way. I should write this as n cross n cross E naught squared, so I can see the direction of the E field instead of the direction of the H field here. Okay, a few comments about this relatively important formula is, right, k is omega over c. So this has an omega to the fourth dependence of the scattering power radiated angular distribution, which means that higher frequencies are scattered more, okay? Lower frequencies are scattered less. So this is the simple argument for why the sky is blue, which I'll elaborate on a little bit now. And in the end, this is just an oscillating dipole, right? So for radiation coming in linear polarized, you'll get a sine squared theta distribution about the incident polarization vector. So let's imagine a source of photons like the sun. And now we've got the Earth over here. This is not exactly to scale. And the Earth has an atmosphere with little people on it. And the little people, when they look up, right, they are looking at light that was scattered, only light that was scattered, if they are looking up, okay? On the other hand, if it's near sunset and the little people are looking more toward the sun, then most of the light that was scattered out of the light from the sun was bluish, omega high, and so the person at sunset sees the remaining light that got through more preferentially, and so at sunset or sunrise, you'll see a reddish tendency to be seeing lower frequency photons, since more of them are left that were not scattered, whereas in the upward in the sky, you'll see higher frequencies, which are blue. And now you can go home and tell your parents you know why the sky is blue. Good old Rayleigh scattering. It can get a little more complicated than that. If you want to know the full reality of this, like what is doing the scattering and under what conditions does this change in a dramatic ways, there's a phenomenon called critical opalescence. And this and other details about the blue sky you can find in Jackson section 10.2c, which is pretty interesting reading. Okay, so that's how where the photons are going and where they would be detected if we are doing a polarization insensitive detection. But let's look at the polarization, which is pretty interesting also. So first of all, we know from an oscillating dipole if you have if it's any real combination of the Cartesian unit vectors x hat, y hat, z hat, and that means real to within an overall phase factor, some phase factor, could multiply that real vector. It doesn't change anything. If it's a real linear combination of those unit vectors, then that means the radiated photons is going to be itself linearly polarized. On the other hand, if we want to consider circular polarization, let's say if light is traveling propagating along the z-axis, positive z-axis, then we could get a circular polarization, which would be described by these unit vectors, epsilon mu, that we talked about, I think, in the context of the vector spherical harmonics and maybe a little bit last semester, where mu is plus or minus 1, defined to be minus or plus 1 over root 2 x hat plus or minus I y hat. Okay, those are the spherical unit vectors. And actually, when we first talked about those last semester, and we were not so much trying to make the exact connection to spherical tensors, I think this minus sign here was omitted. But now we include it because this allows us to connect to spherical harmonics better which are the way we talk about rotations. And it gives this simple formula that n hat dot e mu hat is simply related to a spherical harmonic of order 1 in the n hat direction, which is a useful formula. And remember that we can write any vector, like let's say vector A, can be written as a sum over components of epsilon mu times the projection of epsilon mu dotted into A. And don't forget, when you're projecting, you should take the conjugate of the first vector. And then these obey also this orthogonality. Epsilon mu dot epsilon nu star is delta mu nu. Okay, so that means a circular polarized wave is going to have this type of E mu polarization vector. Like, if we're coming in with an incident wave that's circularly polarized, it would look like this. E naught times E lambda unit vector, and then E to the I kz minus omega t. And lambda is plus or minus 1. Okay. So I want to set up a concrete experimental situation with a photon detector that is polarization sensitive. So we're going to derive the angular distribution that would be detected its power radiated that will pass through an ideal polarization detector. And we'll assume that it is 100% efficient. It will collect every photon of a certain polarization, I'll call E hat. So then the calculation is quite easy. That means the electric vector has to be along E hat to be detected. So what we can do is take the electric vector. Let me ignore this, which is the H vector. This is the electric vector. We can take the dot product of that into the polarization vector of the photons that are detected, of the detector polarization. So this gives the following formula, dp d omega now with polarization sensitivity, which depends on the detected direction in space coming out of our sphere, coordinate origin centered on the sphere, the direction where the detector is, right? Which has some n hat from our dielectric sphere. Right, and it depends on the incident direction and not hat, the radiation coming in, and its polarization, E not hat. So this formula will be 1 over Z naught, the magnitude of E naught squared will be there, capital E naught. We'll have this factor, epsilon r minus 1 over epsilon r plus 2 squared. And the frequency dependence or wavelength dependence we have to keep track of, k to the 4th, a to the 6th over 2. And then finally, the polarization information is all in this vector, e hat, little e hat star, dotted into the direction of the electric field, radiated n hat cross E naught, absolute value of all that. And I can define this quantity we would define normally as the limit, this fundamental quantity now, dp d omega is a function of those four vectors directions. It's the limit as r goes to infinity, right? We're in the radiation zone of r squared times 1 over twice z naught times the detector unit vector, electric unit vector, polarization vector, E star, dotted into the electric field in the scattered radiation, and then the absolute square to get the time average. Okay, so I need to make a drawing of the, because there are a couple of geometrical things we have to pay attention to when we're trying to describe what the polarization looks like in a real situation. Okay, so let's set up a little more careful diagram with our dielectric sphere, incident wave. Here we have the photons coming in, which I will choose to have n0 hat is their incident propagation direction. And then I'll say there is some scattered direction toward a detector, unit vector n hat, and let me draw this n hat vector. These two vectors define the scattering plane. And we'll have to set up our polarization unit vector With reference to that crucial geometrical thing, there will be a scattering angle, of course, theta, where the detector is located compared to the incident direction. And then we'll set up two unit vectors. We'll have one normal to the plane, which I'll call T naught hat, is normal to the scattering plane. And we'll pick the same direction for T hat, will also be normal to the scattering plane. The actual the math formula for T and T naught can be written as N naught cross N hat, right? So that's why I drew these as out of the board, these T unit vectors, this cross product. And notice that I did the right-hand rule with my right hand. Okay, we have two vectors. To complete the coordinate systems, we also need a third orthogonal direction, which we'll take to be S naught as T naught crossed N hat. Okay, so T naught crossed N hat would in this case go here. That's our third unit vector that characterizes the full three-dimensional coordinate system of the incident photons. And similarly, we'll have T naught crossed, T crossed N hat will be our final S unit vector within the scattering plane. Okay, so there, the reason we're doing this, we're going to have to keep track of the polarization vector components in the plane and orthogonal to the plane. Yeah. Yeah, it would. Thanks. That's right. And S then is T cross N hat. Right. Okay, so then as you see, this triad of unit vectors, S naught hat, T naught hat, N naught hat, forms a right-handed coordinate system. And similarly, S, T, and N hat also form a right-handed coordinate system. And what we want to do is write the incident and scattered electric fields in terms of those unit vectors. We'll see some interesting things coming out of these different in-plane versus out-of-plane polarizations components. Okay, so let's write E incident first as S naught times S naught dot E incident. Plus T naught unit vector times T naught dot E incident. And then use the fact again that H incident is 1 over Z naught N naught cross E incident. So I can also write the magnetic field as 1 over Z naught T naught hat times S naught dot E incident minus 1 over Z naught S naught unit vector times T naught dot E incident. And with that, I can calculate the incident pointing vector, how much power is coming in. Toward our dielectric sphere. S incident will again be the time averaged half the real part of E incident cross H incident conjugate, which works out to be equal to 1 over 2 Z naught. Absolute value of S naught dot E incident squared plus absolute value of T naught dot E incident squared, all in the N naught hat direction. Okay, so that'll be an important thing. We're going to need this later when we actually write this as a differential scattering cross section in a few minutes. Notice that there is no interference between these two directions of the electric field. Right, there would be cross terms if there was interference. Or we'd have to add them together and then square them. All right. So now we come to the language of modern physics experiments, differential cross section. So, definition. The differential scattering cross section we write with this symbol, d sigma d omega. It's differential in the solid angles of scattering. And it's not just a differential scattering for all photons, but it's a differential scattering cross-section with polarization sensitivity. Like for this experiment I set up here, it's that differential cross-section with those possibilities of an incident polarization or a detected polarization. Okay, here is the definition. This is defined to be 1 over the magnitude of the incident pointing vector, I should say, with a given initial propagation and polarization vector, times the scattered power radiated, dp d omega, from that initial to a final n hat e hat. That is d sigma d omega. That depends on those four unit vectors. And again, the incident pointing vector was already written over there as basically E naught dot E incident squared. Go ahead and write that also. Okay, so I'm going to consider four separate cases for these vectors. Maybe I should leave this diagram up. And for notation, I'm going to introduce something that has most of the dimensional units of the cross section. Namely, epsilon r minus 1 over epsilon r plus 2 squared times k to the 4th, a to the 6th, right? Which has the units of cross-section. It's area to the 6th power divided by area to the 4th power. No. Length to the 6th power divided by length to the 4th power, which is an area. Okay, that has the units of cross-section. So, first case, d sigma d omega, for the case where E hat is along S hat. So, the incident polarization vector of the photons coming in is in the scattering plane. And the final detector is sensitive only to photons in the scattering plane. That's E hat is S hat, and E naught is S naught hat. Okay, so we're oscillating the electrons or the electric field this way, and we're going to detect electrons in the scattering plane only in that direction. So that formula is sigma naught, and this scary vector S hat conjugate dotted into N hat cross, N hat cross S naught squared. Okay, and again, these are both in the scattering plane. So if I actually look at the angles here, I have S and I could draw S naught on this same diagram. Then if this angle is theta, then this angle between S naught and S is also theta. And this angle here would be pi over 2 minus theta. Yeah, I think that makes sense. As you imagine tilting this down and getting a small theta, this angle will also get closer and make a small theta there. Okay. So basically, just from this trig, we know that n hat cross s naught could be written as t naught sine of pi over 2 minus theta. Which is cos theta t hat. Some other quantities, n hat cross t hat, of course, is minus s hat. And so n hat cross s naught. Is minus s hat cos theta. I'm going through this trig pretty fast, but you can go through it slowly on your own if you want to check my reasoning. And so finally, this unit vector here, I claim is its absolute. It is just minus cos theta inside the absolute value. Okay, so this case one, the differential cross section, d sigma d omega for e hat along s hat and e naught hat along s naught hat, both polarization vectors in the scattering plane, is simply sigma naught cos squared theta. For that polarization sensitivity and incident. Going through the same reasoning, let me just write this without heavy calculation. You can see d sigma d omega for the case of incident in the t direction, out of plane. Out-of-plane incident polarization, but in-plane detected polarization. That's just zero, right? Because t dot s hat is zero, and t naught, and t is equal to t naught. Okay, so if you're oscillating in this direction out of plane, you won't have any components of the E field, not so surprising, in the plane. Similarly, if you come in with incident out of plane, This was E is T hat, and E naught was S hat, S naught hat. Now I'm doing D sigma D omega. In the other case, orthogonal case, where E hat is detected in the plane, but the incident radiation is out of the plane. And that is also zero. But the other non-trivial case is now both incident and detected are out of the plane. Case four, the last case, d sigma d omega, both out of the plane, incident and detected. And this is sigma naught magnitude of T star dotted into this n cross T naught squared, which is just sigma naught times minus T hat dot T naught squared, which is just sigma naught. Okay, so there's only really two non-trivial combinations. So in terms of our, let's talk about the Earth and the Sun for a minute, just to make sure we're all on the same wavelength. So to speak, you probably all have gone through these arguments in your undergraduate courses, but let's go through it. The basics, again, thinking of light coming from the sun, sending photons to our Earth. And here is the little person. So, in the radiation coming from the sun, there will be, right, combination of two photons, basically. If we think it's mostly unpolarized coming from the sun, then there will be as much coming, oscillating in this electric field this way and in the plane of the board. So when you look up, the little person looks up, straight up above, right? There could be a dipole moment created by this S-naught dipole oscillating this way. Okay, but that will produce no radiation going straight down to the little person because that sine theta is zero along that direction. So this contributes nothing to the photons coming down. All the photons, as I look up, and the sun was over, well, over there, I guess. I should do it this way. The sun was over there, and I'm looking up. The only polarization I should see of these photons is the electric field going this way, which you could see if you had a polarizer or polarized sunglasses. You should find it's close to 100% polarized in that direction. But at sunrise or sunset, right, we're not talking about the scattered radiation, and if it was unpolarized, then the light getting through, which was not scattered for the most part, light coming through, is should be unpolarized also. You guys all learned that as undergrads. That sort of logic doesn't ring a bell. Well, I'm glad I covered it then. There are some other things we can do with this because these aren't the only experiments one might imagine doing. In some cases, the incident light will be unpolarized, like we were talking about here. Then we must average, it's all the same rules you learn when you learn how to combine quantum probabilities, basically. You average over the initial distribution and you sum over final states. That's how you calculate when you have some averaging or non-perfect detectors of only a single quantum state. Okay, so for unpolarized incident light, we average over, take our d sigma d omega, average it over the two polarizations. And so then we could measure the differential cross section. We could still have polarization detection, but no polarization coming in. So the differential cross section as one example for unpolarized incident light to be scattered through an angle theta, for the photon propagation direction, with the measured light parallel to the scattering plane, is one experiment you might do with a detector. And we have to just take the average of the corresponding cases over here. Okay, so we're in the scattering plane, so we're talking about the two cases, 1 and 3, where the detected photons have polarization in the scattered plane. It's the average of sigma naught cos squared theta with 0. And so this fancy averaging calculation is just going to give 1/2 of case 1. Call that d sigma parallel d omega, which is this average d sigma d omega for E hat equals S hat, and that will equal 1/2 sigma naught cos squared theta. Okay, so it'll be peaked in the forward direction. The other case we might do for unpolarized incident radiation, if the measured light is perpendicular to the scattering plane, can go through the same calculation and average these two, 2 and 4, now, which will give simply d sigma perpendicular d omega of theta is, interestingly, just a constant and theta independent. The other case that might be interesting is to have unpolarized incident light and no polarization sensitivity. Okay, so again, we apply the rule we learn in quantum mechanics, at least that's where I learned it for the first time. Even though this is a classical calculation, it's the same rule that we have to average over the initial polarizations and sum over the final polarizations to get the differential cross-section for scattering of one incident unpolarized photon. I can just say it in quantum language, even though it's a classical calculation. All this would apply to individual photons hitting a scatterer one by one. Average over the initial states and sum over the final states. Let me write it, because it's such an important rule. And my chalk has died. And when we do that, okay, so basically it's taking these, it's basically summing all those four but dividing by two. In that case, d sigma d omega will be sigma naught over 2 times 1 plus cos squared theta. For unpolarized source and detector. In quantum mechanics, don't forget, if you have an unpolarized photon source, or light source, then there is no state vector psi for an unpolarized photon, right? You can only describe that as a statistical mixture of the two orthogonal polarization states, or use a density matrix. And similarly, in classical physics, you have an analog of that, that there is no E field of an unpolarized, of the photons in an unpolarized beam, or of the electromagnetic waves. There is no single E field, no single H field. You have to do calculations when you have incoherent source. You have to, you know, choose your two orthogonal polarization, do the entire calculation separately, and then do the appropriate averaging or summing over final states, averaging over initial or summing over final states. But if you pick one photon in an unpolarized beam, you cannot say what its electric field is. It just has some probability to have one electric field or the other, even classically. Astronomers like to measure the polarization of photons coming from a source, right?
Yes.
Let's define the polarization of photons coming from a source, because that'll tell us, like, how the star evolved and what its conditions were. Maybe.
Or like the magnetic
field from like a supernova. That too. I don't think that's the only thing relevant. What? Could be, yeah, that. Or like if you, what do you call this, an accretion? If there's like an accretion direction, won't there be tend to be maybe linear polarization along that axis or something? Like you've got a black hole and you've got like something and it's feeding in lots of plasma into the black hole. I thought there would be maybe some directionality to the polarization reflecting that. But magnetic fields are also a good one. I've written papers about that, of magnetic white dwarf stars and things like that, which have a magnetic field around 10 to the 9 Gauss. Okay, so here is how you talk about that quantitatively. We'll define the polarization of light detected at some angle. Let's say it's observed at some scattering angle of the propagation direction. Relative to the propagation direction, call it theta, then this quantity, capital pi of theta, is defined to be d sigma d omega perpendicular minus d sigma d omega parallel over their sum. Which in the case we had of a long wavelength dipole radiator, dipole scatterer, that was sigma naught over 2 times 1 minus cos squared theta over sigma naught over 2, 1 plus cos squared theta, which is could also be written as just this dimensionless ratio, purely geometrical, sine squared theta over 1 plus cos squared theta for our simple dipole radiator. Okay, so you've got photons coming, and you know what your scattering plane is. You just take the perpendicular polarization minus the parallel in plane. Take the difference over the sum. And then you make a theory about why the value coming from such and such astrophysical object is what you measure. Oh, we're out of time. I should stop talking. There it is.